Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979 inspired various freedom movements worldwide, including in Africa, a continent that endured centuries of colonialism and continues to grapple with new colonialism. This revolution, led by Imam Khomeini, symbolized resistance to Western dominance, particularly against the U.S. and Britain. Its message of self-determination and independence resonated with African nations' struggles against colonial and neocolonial oppression. At the time of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, southern African countries such as South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe were still fighting for liberation from colonial rule. The Islamic Republic of Iran played a significant role in supporting the eventual liberation of these nations. In 1992, Nelson Mandela, a hero of South Africa's liberation struggle, visited the Islamic Republic of Iran 2 years before his election as president. During his arrival in Tehran, Mandela expressed his gratitude, stating, "We are here to thank the Iranian government and nation for their support in the black people's struggle against apartheid." The Islamic Revolution continues to influence the broader anti-colonial movements in Africa. Africa's struggle inspired by Iran's Islamic Revolution. Nelson Mandela visited the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1992. Upon his arrival in Tehran, Mandela said, "We are here to thank the Iranian government and nation for their support in the black people's struggle against apartheid." During his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Mandela addressed him as "my leader." During the 16th summit of the Non-Aligned Movement held in Tehran in August 2012, the then Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, met the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. In the meeting, Mugabe said Iran's revolutionary orientation and its avoidance of empty slogans are two of the reasons why freedom-seeking countries of the world were happy about Iran's presidency of the Non-Aligned Movement. This statement clearly reflected the view that most people in Africa view Iran as a country that is indeed serious in combating colonial powers.
Nelson Mandela's statement during his 1992 visit to Tehran reflects the deep ideological connection between Iran's Islamic Revolution and Africa's liberation movements. The Islamic Revolution wasn't merely a political upheaval, but a declaration of resistance against global injustice, colonialism, and systemic oppression. These principles directly parallel South Africa's anti-apartheid struggle.
In its message of condolences following the martyrdom of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, Uganda President said his legacy of dedication and unity will continue to inspire many. Museveni noted that Martyr Raisi was a Shia, but he went to a Sunni mosque, and while there, he met Uganda's Archbishop. President Museveni asserted that the progressive people of Africa are with Iran.
"So I came to assure the Iranian people that we are with you, with the progressive people of Africa. We know who is saying what and why, and we are never fooled by anybody who is playing games."
The statement by President Museveni is viewed as a testament to Iran's Islamic Revolution dedication to unity and progress in Africa.
Well, President Raisi's inclusive actions, such as visiting Sunni mosques and meeting with Christian leaders, tend to exemplify or illustrate the Islamic Revolution's foundational ethos of unity. This gesture, however, goes beyond symbolic outreach. It reaffirms that shared values like justice and equality and human dignity transcend religious or sectarian divisions. Iran has long promoted this message, encouraging unity to resist external exploitation and interference. In Africa, where colonial powers historically weaponized religious and ethnic differences to divide populations, Iran's example is particularly relevant. President Museveni's proposal to memorialize Raisi's meetings with Uganda's Sunni and Christian leaders reflects how such unity can inspire harmony and cooperation. By prioritizing collective strength over division, Iran sets a model for nations navigating the complexities of pluralistic societies. For Africa, this legacy underscores the potential of unity in achieving sovereignty, peace, and development.
Iran supported the Southwest Africa People's Organization, known by its acronym SWAPO, a political party in Namibia and the former independence movement in the country. Iran allowed SWAPO to have diplomatic representation in Tehran. Iran also offered military, educational, and diplomatic support to SWAPO. The current president of Namibia, Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa, as a foreign minister, met the then Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, in 2017. During the meeting, she stated that the relations between the two countries were established even before Namibia's independence, when the country's people were fighting for liberation. She said Iran was among the countries that supported Namibia's independence through backing leaders of the Southwest African People's Organization. Iran's support for Namibia's independence movement was quite significant.
First of all, we will continue to thank the Iranian Revolution for the support that they gave SWAPO during the National Liberation Movement. It was a period of hardship which needed a lot of international support and solidarity. Indeed, it was a fight and a battle against apartheid colonialism. It was a fight against human subjugation. It was a fight against the exploitation of man by colonial forces. It was a fight against racial segregation. It was a fight for the total redemption and liberation of the people of Namibia. The Namibian people, the Namibian liberation struggle, gained a lot of support from Iran, yes, in terms of whatever logistical offers were given to the People's Liberation Army of Namibia. And so it was highly significant because they contributed to free a nation under the clutches of imperialism.
Sanctions enforced by imperialist powers against genuinely sovereign nations serve as tools of coercion. In recent times, the use of sanctions has become a common tactic for punishing countries that challenge Western dominance. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, believes that nations such as Iran and Zimbabwe, targeted by Western sanctions, should unite and face this challenge. Mnangagwa made the remarks when he hosted the late Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, in July 2023.
It is critically important that we, the victims of Western sanctions, are talking to each other. The authors of these sanctions who don't want us to talk to each other, but because we are both victims, it is critically important that we show them that we are united.
Sanctions were imposed on Iran immediately after the Islamic Revolution and have continued to evolve over the last 45 years. Iran has been able to turn sanctions into an opportunity to develop. The unity between Zimbabwe and Iran is critical in resisting sanctions and attaining self-sufficiency in various sectors. Iran, a role model for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Province of Sahel States, comprising Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, was established in September 2023 to address regional instability and security threats. This anti-colonial alliance draws strategic inspiration from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Sahel Alliance leaders are particularly influenced by Iran's sustained resistance to international pressure and its ability to build regional influence through ideological alignment, self-reliance, and strategic partnerships. They admire Iran's use of asymmetric strategies, grassroots mobilization, and emphasis on sovereignty to counter global powers. The alliance aims to resist external interference and tackle shared challenges, including terrorism and economic instability, more effectively. Mali's Defense Minister, Sadio Camara, stated during a visit to Iran in May 2023 that his country is determined to assert sovereignty over its borders and take full control of its security. He further remarked that the Islamic Republic of Iran serves as a role model in this regard. How does the Islamic Republic of Iran serve as a role model for countries that are striving to establish genuine independence? Since the early years of South Africa's post-apartheid democracy, significant pressure was placed on the country's founding president, Nelson Mandela, by Western imperialist powers, particularly by the United States, regarding his stance on various issues. Each time, Mandela stood his ground, firmly asserting South Africa's independence. In 1996, the then Iranian president, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, visited South Africa and was warmly received by Mandela. In a news conference following their meeting, President Mandela defended his country's strong ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran and categorically stated that South Africa would not accept being told which countries could be its friends.
But we form our friendships on the basis of principle. And those who are with us when we're all alone will continue to be our friend. And the fact that any particular country may be their enemies does not influence our attitude. We are a sovereign and independent country, and we're prepared to defend that sovereignty and independence. And no country can dictate to us.
The message of Nelson Mandela was a pointer to the role the victory of the Islamic Revolution had on the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Western imperialist powers have long sought to isolate Iran in Africa, but have failed dismally, as many countries in the continent have maintained their non-aligned policy. African countries ignored calls by Western powers and the Zionist regime and maintained cordial ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Nelson Mandela said something that was right. No other nation is supposed to dictate to another one as to who should be a friend. The Iranian revolution has her own characteristics. The Iranian revolution has proven to be a progressive revolution and not a stagnant revolution like many other revolutions that we have seen all over the world. In the relationship of one country to another, no other country should be like a policeman to say, don't relate to this or that. Countries in Africa are sovereign states and have the right to decide who they should relate with.
Niger's revolutionary government recently cut military ties with France and the United States. This decision was made amid the country's determination to assert its independence. Niger's Prime Minister, Lamine Zeyn, says the termination of military cooperation and bilateral relations between his country and the United States was due to American threats and Washington's opposition to the African nation's partnership with Iran and Russia. During his visit to Iran in January 2024, he met the then Iran's president, Martar Ebrahim Raisi, and described Iran as a reliable partner for Niger. The revolutionary government of Niger views Iran as a reliable partner and not France or the United States.
Niger's decision to strengthen ties with Iran instead of traditional partners like France, quite a controversial partnership or relationship at that, and the United States reflects a broader rejection of neo-colonial relationships. Historically, Western powers have maintained an influence because of these neo-colonial relationships through exploitative practices, resource extraction, and of course, the devastating impact of military presence and escape often at the expense of local sovereignty and economic development. In contrast, I would say that Iran approaches partnerships based on mutual respect and shared development goals. Iran's focus on non-interference and support for infrastructure, technology transfer, innovation, and education aligns with Niger's aspirations for self-reliance.
The second Iran and Africa International Economic Conference was held last April in Tehran with the objective of boosting economic ties with African countries. The event was attended by the then president, Martar Ebrahim Raisi, and high-ranking representatives from over 30 African countries. On the sidelines of the second Iran-Africa International Conference, the then prime minister of Burkina Faso met and talked with Martar Raisi and said, "Contrary to Western propaganda, Iran is an independent, developing, and advanced country that adds to its attractiveness to develop and strengthen relations with in all fields. This is a very critical point that African countries are no longer paying attention to Western propaganda."
So the remarks by Burkina Faso's prime minister highlights a transformative shift in Africa's global outlook. Historically, Western, or should I say corporate, propaganda has portrayed nations like Iran as isolated or regressive or aggressive. But African leaders are increasingly basing their judgments on direct experience with Iran in other countries and direct engagement. During the second Iran-Africa International Conference, African leaders witnessed Iran's achievements in science, technology, and transfer, and infrastructure in particular, clear proof of its progress despite decades of sanctions and international pressure. This seems to have created a culture of resilience. This rejection of Western narratives symbolizes Africa's growing confidence in its ability to assess partnerships independently and on its own strength. Iran's independence and self-reliance resonates deeply with African nations, and of course, vice versa, striving to break free from colonial dependency. As African nations prioritize sovereignty and development over external approval, they are creating alliances with nations like Iran that embody these values. This shift represents a broader realignment in global politics, where Africa is asserting its agency and embracing relationships that respect, truly respect, its aspirations.
The Alliance of Sahel States is a confederation of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso that has boldly rejected foreign militarization and neocolonial domination. These three countries that enjoy popular support have resolved to strengthen ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran because they view the Islamic Revolution as an inspiration. Pan-Africanists are calling for further strengthening the common bonds between the Islamic Revolution and Africa.
The military cooperation between Africa and Iran in terms of training, support, and logistics need to continue, and then for Africa to remain strong in her own military strides. Any foreign military base in Africa is in a way diluting the sovereignty of that country. Why is it that Africa do not have military bases in the US or in Europe? Why is it that Africa do not have that? But they rather come in. Why? It's because of one thing, to have dominance on our mineral resources and to exploit. That is all. And so when it comes to the military advancement, military strength, military potency of Iran, is something that should be shared with African states as best practices. Exchange of military lessons or experiences is far better between sovereign states than one state to come and then situate a whole military base in that country.
Thank you. the limelight.
The Doctors for America advocacy group has initiated a lawsuit challenging an executive order by President Donald Trump issued within hours of his second inauguration. And also a judge has told government agencies to restore web pages and data removed after Donald Trump's executive order. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered government agencies to restore public access to health-related web pages and datasets that they removed to comply with an executive order by President Donald Trump. U.S. District Judge John Bates in Washington agreed to issue a temporary restraining order requested by the Doctors for America advocacy group. The judge instructed the government to restore access to several web pages and datasets that the group identified as missing from websites and to identify others that also were taken down without adequate notice or reasoned explanation. On 20th of January, his first day back in the White House, Donald Trump signed an executive order for agencies to use the term sex and not gender in federal policies and documents. In response, the Office of Personnel Management's acting director required agency heads to eliminate any programs that take down any websites that promote gender ideology. Doctors for America, represented by the Public Citizen Litigation Group, sued the Office of Personnel Management, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and the Department of Health and Human Services. The nonprofit group Doctors for America cited the executive order's adverse impact on two of its members. A Chicago clinic doctor who would have consulted CDC resources to address a recent chlamydia outbreak in the high school, and a Yale School medicine doctor who relies on CDC resources about contraceptives and sexually transmitted infections. The judge wrote, "These doctors' time and effort are valuable, scarce resources, and being forced to spend them elsewhere makes their jobs harder and their treatment of patients less effective." Continue with the Associated Press's coverage of this story. The case is among dozens of lawsuits challenging executive orders that Donald Trump, a Republican, issued within hours of his second inauguration. The scrubbed material includes reports on HIV prevention, a CDC webpage for providing clinicians with guidance on reproductive health care, and an FDA study on sex differences in the clinical evaluation of medical products. Removing important information from the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, webpages is delaying patient care, hampering research, and hindering doctors' ability to communicate with patients, the plaintiff's attorneys argued in the court filing. They wrote, "The agency's actions create a dangerous gap in the scientific data available to monitor and respond to disease outbreaks, halt or hamper key health research, and deprive physicians of resources that impact clinical practice." U.S. government lawyers argued that Doctors for America's claims fall well short of clearly showing irreparable harm to any plaintiffs and are unlikely to succeed in their merits. They wrote, "Either failure provides a sufficient basis for denying extraordinary relief." During a hearing on Monday, 10th of February, the judge asked plaintiff's attorney, Zachary Shelley, if the removal of the online material harms the American public. Zachary Shelley said the doctors' interests align with their patients. There is immense harm to the public, Shelley emphasized. There are massive threats to public health here. The judge concluded that the harm in this case ultimately trickles down to everyday Americans seeking doctors' care. The judge wrote, if those doctors cannot provide these individuals the care that they need and deserve within the scheduled and often limited time frame, there is a chance that some individuals will not receive medical treatment, including for severe life-threatening conditions. Doctors for America is a not-for-profit group representing more than 27,000 physicians and doctors and medical trainees. It was born from an earlier organization that pushed for health reform and supported Barack Obama, a Democrat, when he was running for president. The American newspaper Atlanta News First in Atlanta, Georgia, has also covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge on Tuesday ordered government agencies to restore public access to health-related web pages and data sets that they removed to comply with an executive order issued by President Donald Trump. U.S. District Judge John Bates in Washington agreed to issue a temporary restraining order requested by Doctors for America, which is a nonprofit advocacy group. The judge instructed the government to restore access to several web pages and data sets that the group identified as missing from websites and to identify others that were taken down without adequate notice or reasoned explanation. On 20th of January, when Donald Trump started his second term in office, he signed an executive order for agencies to use the term sex and not gender in federal policies and documents. In response, the Office of Personnel Management's acting director required government agency heads to eliminate any programs that take down any websites that promote gender ideology. Doctors for America, a nonprofit group, cited Donald Trump's executive order's adverse impact on two of its members, a doctor from Chicago, Illinois, and another doctor from the Yale School of Medicine, who relies on CDC resources about contraceptives and sexually transmitted infections. Doctors for America said these doctors' time and efforts are valuable and scarce resources, and they're being harmed by Donald Trump's executive order. The scrub material on the websites include reports on HIV prevention, a CDC webpage for providing clinicians with guidance on reproductive health care, and an FDA study on sex differences in the clinical evaluation of medical products.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution, February 11th, 2019. The Islamic Revolution showed us the way out of the weak, dependent, and corrupt economy of the Pahlavi era. However, feeble performances have posed internal and external challenges to the country's economy. The external challenges include the enemy's sanctions, temptations that would be rendered less effective or even ineffective if the internal challenges are resolved. The internal challenges consist of structural defects and managerial weaknesses. The main defects include economic reliance on oil, government interference in sectors of the economy that do not fit into the sphere of government's responsibilities, relying on imports rather than domestic strength and potentials, very limited exploitations of the country's human resources potentials, defective and unbalanced budgeting, and finally, lack of consistency in executive economic policies, disrespecting priorities and excessive and even wasteful expenses in parts of state organizations. The result is problems in people's livelihoods, including the high rate of unemployment among the youth, low income of lower classes, etc. The solution to these problems lies in the strong, responsible, and lively implementation of policies delineated by the economy of resistance that need to be outlined, followed up, and acted upon by administrations.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The country's economic intra-production becoming productive and knowledge-based, making the economy popular, avoiding authoritarian government oversight, and extroversion using aforementioned potentials are among important examples of these solutions. A young, wise, faithful, and knowledgeable committee of economy experts inside the government can undoubtedly accomplish these aims. The times ahead must be employed for action by the committee. The beloved young individuals across the nation should know that all solutions lie within the country. Assuming that economic problems are merely the result of sanctions and sanctions are because of resistance against imperialism and not submitting to the enemy, so the solution is to kneel before the enemy and kiss the wolf's paw is an unforgivable mistake. This completely false analysis, although sometimes emitted from the mouth and pens of some ignorant individuals inside the country, has its roots in foreign think tanks and conspirers who intend to induce them in policymakers, decision makers, and the general public inside the country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pro-justice demonstrators calling on British court to drop the charges against a man they believe was unjustly arrested and charged.
I'm here to support Chris Nyhem. I think I've got the right to protest, as everybody has in a democratic, so-called democratic society. I think it's appalling what's happening.
I was on that demonstration with Chris. We broke no laws. This is an attempt to shut down the right to demonstrate, in particular to shut down the right to demonstrate about the outrage in Gaza.
Here's the backstory. Chris Nyhem, the founder of the anti-war group Stop the War Coalition, seen here, was apprehended and later released during a pro-Palestine march in central London on January 18th. That prompted clashes between demonstrators and the Metropolitan Police, who handcuffed 77 of them under the so-called Public Orders Act. Legislation that the demonstrators here say has given police too many powers.
Police have been granted excessive powers, which are a threat to the right to free assembly, and that is a fault in the legislation, and it's a fault in the way in which the police are applying the legislation. They've overstepped the mark, even that a bad piece of law gave them.
The reason behind the whole episode, the Met's reversal on an agreement with the Palestine Solidarity Demonstration organizers, with plan to march from the BBC building to Whitehall, where the government offices are located. The Met's justification, purported disruptions to a synagogue in the vicinity of the public broadcaster.
There's been no evidence of any threat to any synagogue, and on every single demonstration we have thousands of Jewish people marching with us. And then on the day, from the beginning, as we've heard people assert today, people who were there, they began to very aggressively and violently arrest people, many of them simply for being standing in the wrong place.
Ben Jamal, who was also charged with public order offenses, believes the aim of the police crackdown was to distract the public from the real reason for those demonstrations, which he says are now more crucial given the U.S. President Donald Trump's plans to forcibly displace Palestinians from Gaza.
The violent arrests in January came after 15 months of demonization by pro-Zionist politicians and the media here in Britain. The fear here is that at this rate, Britons could find themselves in a situation where they may be arrested for simply expressing solidarity for Palestinians. Saeed Poreza, London.
As Israeli forces escalate their assaults on refugee camps in Tul Kerem and Jenin, entire neighborhoods have been reduced to rubble. Families who have lived in these camps for generations now find themselves without homes, forced to flee with nothing but clothes on their backs.
They destroyed our home, beat us, and expelled us with nothing. I only took my medicine. We kept moving as they forced us from place to place. After 5 days at home, they stormed in, fired heavily, and destroyed everything. Exhausted, I was taken by ambulance with my 5 grandchildren. Now we have nowhere to go.
Israeli forces have intensified operations targeting refugee camps and targeted the residents there with no respect to humanitarian law.
We never imagined living through this. The army treated us inhumanely, denying even our elderly their wheelchairs, telling them to manage on their own. We left with nothing. Some didn't even get to take their IDs.
But beyond physical destruction, the human cost is even greater. Families who have lived in these camps for generations now find themselves homeless, forced into overcrowded shelters with very little access to basic necessities.
They forced us out with nothing. The camp is in ruins, streets destroyed, homes burned. Now we have nowhere to go.
For many, this forced eviction is not just temporary displacement. It is a part of a broader policy aimed at erasing Palestinian refugee camps altogether. As the attacks continue, so does the uncertainty of when or if they will ever be able to rebuild their lives. Naqa Ahmed, Tul Kerem, Occupied West Bank.
Massive global opposition continues against President Donald Trump's insistence that the United States will invade and occupy Gaza and force the Gazans to relocate.
It's not a complex thing to do. And with the United States being in control of that piece of land, a fairly large piece of land, you're going to have stability in the Middle East for the first time. And the Palestinians, or the people that live now in Gaza, will be living beautifully in another location.
Jordan's King Abdullah publicly rejected Trump's calls to accept more Palestinian refugees, but many speculate that he was offered some major incentive by Trump in private.
The visit of King Abdullah after the visit of Netanyahu, it depends on what they are trying to offer in order to either pass the any plan, because you know there are something that is announced, but what is behind the scenes and behind the doors could be totally something different, and we are looking for what is really under the table more than what is really on the table, because that is the most dangerous one.
In 2023, Jordan and Egypt trailed only Ukraine and Israel in total U.S. foreign aid. But Trump has threatened to end the money and weapon transfers to both Muslim countries if they don't accept the 2 million war-torn Gazans. Monarchy-dominated Jordanians have deep ties to Palestine, and there has long been speculation that Israeli crimes could eventually spark a Republican revolution in Jordan.
At an estimated 3 million, the number of Palestinians living in Jordan is about the same as the number of Palestinians living in the West Bank. It also makes Palestinian refugees half of Jordan's entire population.
Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi surprisingly canceled a Washington visit scheduled for next week, underscoring how opposed the Muslim world is to Trump's imperialist designs on Gaza.
One for sure, the Palestinians are not going to leave the land. And we have seen that in Gaza. And those who have not seen what the Palestinians in Gaza said, they need to see it again, because they have unwavering resolve that they will stay in the land no matter what, despite all the killings and the bombing that they did. Already, according to the Egyptian and the Jordanian, they have announced that they will not accept this plan. So we hope that they will, hold their feet on the grounds that they will not accept that plan.
A new poll found that 74% of Americans oppose the idea of the U.S. taking control of Gaza and displacing the Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
From a simple slideshow to a feature documentary, Gaza is Our Home uncovers the true scale of suffering endured by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. To depict the untold realities faced by Gazans, Munir Shaar, who produced this film, shares the story of his 27 family members killed in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Shaar takes his audience back to 2021 during a trip to visit his now martyred family in Gaza, through phone videos of his cousin's wedding, his grandmother's home, and motorcycle rides in the beautiful streets of Gaza. After a screening at the Spectacle Theater in Brooklyn, New York, we sat with Shaar, who explained why he made this film.
My documentary was my attempt to use the art of filmmaking, the art that is being used in contrast to dehumanize us. That's what propaganda truly is. It's using art and media to demonize my people, my family. My family needs more than just a ceasefire. They need their homes rebuilt, and they need us to care about them, right? So I think that's my my effort with this film, is to continue to grow beyond just what a film can do.
The film takes a look into the lives of Gazans who are currently suffering. Given that context, we asked Shaar about a controversial plan announced by U.S. President Donald Trump to take over Gaza.
With the current events surrounding Trump wanting to take my family's home, the home that houses my grandma, he doesn't have a right to do so. There's no American that has the right to go into that land, and especially my grandma's home, and pretend that they never existed. My grandma does exist, and she... Her life has been tormented for decades. And so I asked Trump, come watch my documentary and maybe you'll realize whose home it really is.
Shahid concluded the show with a sentimental phrase that was sure to stay in everyone's minds when he said he used drones as a real estate videographer to make houses for sale look beautiful, while U.S.-supplied drones were destroying his own home. Over the past year and a half, Palestinians showcased different forms of resistance against the Israeli genocide. Munir Shaer, like many Gazans, chose to resist through art by making Gaza is Our Home to refute the media's dehumanization and reclaim the stolen Palestinian narrative. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
The Israeli regime is continuing an all-out war on the Palestinian people, opening a new front in the occupied West Bank ever since reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. The city of Jenin is under fire, with the situation there being far from normal or stable. The residents face daily violations of their basic rights, including frequent military raids, checkpoints that restrict the movement of people and goods, and arbitrary arrests targeting young people and even children.
I was released from prison this week, and I didn't know that there was an invasion of the camp. When my chains were removed, I went directly to the camp, but what I saw reminded me of the 2002 invasion, with houses completely destroyed and burned, and the forced displacement of citizens, as the camp appeared completely empty.
The Israeli occupation has entirely destroyed the Jenin refugee camp and forcibly displaced over 20,000 residents, leaving behind their homes, documents, and personal belongings. The displaced residents are expected to seek shelter in other cities across the West Bank, as destruction caused by the Israeli assault makes their return impossible.
There is no shelter for us. We sleep in hospital, and it seems we have remained homeless. We don't know where we'll go. Only God knows our fate. The camp appears to be completely destroyed. All the houses have been ruined. It is unbelievable to the mind and the eye what we see. But we say thank God in any case.
The city's infrastructure is damaged as well, making it harder for people to access important services like healthcare and education. The people in Jenin live in constant fear and insecurity, with their daily lives affected by the threat of violence or loss of their loved ones. All these issues make life in Jenin far from normal, demanding an urgent international action to end the occupation and ensure that the Palestinian people can live freely and with dignity.
Israel's increasing crimes in the occupied West Bank after the Gaza ceasefire have resulted more and more displacement of residents in Jenin and the rise in settler attacks against the Palestinians. Tiba Asi, occupied Jenin.
The Yemeni revolution of February 11th was part of uprisings that swept several Arab countries in 2011. Yemenis in different cities across the country protested against the government of then President Ali Abdullah Saleh, demanding political change. A year later, however, a deal that was clenched under international pressure transferred power to Ali Abdullah Saleh's deputy, Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Many saw this as a compromise that kept the same political elite in control, particularly the Islah Party.
There is no doubt that the February 11th revolution led by Yemeni youth played a major role in removing the regime that had ruled the country for 33 years. The revolution had great goals to remove the centers of corruption that had exploited Yemeni wealth, putting the country under control of America, Britain, and Saudi Arabia.
In the years that followed, Yemen's economic struggles worsened and political instability deepened. Many people, including supporters of Ansarullah movement, felt that their revolution had been hijacked. Ansarullah members also rejected what they called the deviation from the revolution's goals, demanding a true shift in power. On September 21st, 2014, Ansarullah and its allied tribes took control of the capital Sana'a, forcing Hadi and his government officials to flee. Ansarullah and its allies hailed the achievement as a victory against corruption and foreign influence, calling it the true revolution to free Yemen from external interference.
Why have the revolutions of February 11th and September 21st changed the course of events in Yemen? The country remains at a crossroads. The struggle for sovereignty, stability, and economic recovery continues. Yemenis say true revolutions are measured by their outcomes, not just by the fall of regimes. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran Jew International Exhibition has kicked off in Tehran. The exhibition fosters collaboration, allowing geospatial organizations, equipment providers, universities, private companies, and active startups to exchange ideas of their achievements and capabilities. The exhibition also offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in this field.
We aim to transform this exhibition into a catalyst for all users and producers of geographic information, inspiring them to develop solutions for the current and future challenges facing our country. This includes addressing various environmental issues such as air and ocean pollution, climate change, and water supply.
The exhibition stands as West Asia's largest gathering of the geospatial industry, promoting knowledge exchange among industry leaders, researchers, and policymakers. The geospatial industry has traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, climate change, and environmental monitoring.
What we are showcasing at this exhibition are products resulting from advancements in technology and science that have evolved into a thriving industry, significantly contributing to our country's development. This exhibition aims to highlight scientific progress in geography and spatial information, fostering collaboration and synergy among all participants. We warmly invite our friendly neighboring countries to join us in enhancing cooperation in this vital field.
This is the third time I'm visiting this expo, and I feel very proud to see Iran's development, and it is progressing at such a fast pace, especially under sanctions.
According to experts, approximately 70% of global challenges are tied to the environment and require environmental solutions that depend on precise and reliable spatial data, along with advancements in surveying and remote sensing. Iran has utilized its resources to generate knowledge, achieving significant advancements. This exhibition showcasing Iran's progress in geotechnology will run until February 14th. Farzan Ashurian, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. President Donald Trump ignited a firestorm of controversy earlier this month with his latest remarks suggesting that the U.S. should take over and own Gaza and remove its people. Over two-thirds of Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives in a letter called on Trump to take back his, quote, dangerous Gaza comments. U.N. Special Rapporteur on Palestine Francesca Albanese slammed Trump's proposal as grotesque and insulting. Palestinians in Gaza have also reacted with anger and rejection, that is, to Trump's comments. They argue that Gaza is their home and that the proposal ignores their rights and historical connection to the land. Hamas, the governing authority in Gaza, has also called Trump's idea ridiculous and absurd. Joining us on this edition of Spotlight, we have Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. And we also have journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes